Question. What's the difference between ham and eggs? Someone knows, I know. Difference between ham and eggs is the ham is committed. The chicken just contributed some eggs, but the ham contributed itself. So the difference between ham and eggs is the level of commitment. Well, as we look at this passage, as we look at the book of Jonah, Jonah definitely went along for the ride here. He didn't start out, what we'd say, all that committed, but he certainly got there, although he drifted away from that as well. Let's look at a little bit of background here to Jonah once again. The author is Jonah, Amittai's son. That's mentioned in 2 Kings 14, as well as being mentioned in Jonah 1:1. The book was written to the northern kingdom. This is after the split of Israel into two kingdoms, Judah in the south and Israel, or Samaria, up in the north. And so this is a prophet who lived in the north and ministered to the northern kingdom. And we saw last week that he had a long-term and successful ministry in which he made a rather astounding prophecy about Jeroboam II reconquering all the territory that had been lost earlier. As we think about a man like Jonah, we'd say, why would a man who had a career that the Lord obviously blessed, why would he have as catastrophic a failure as happens here in this book? Well, the events in the book, and we'll get into the demonstrations of that next week, is in 759 BC. This is 37 years before the northern kingdom, before Israel fell. It fell in 722 B.C. What I have given hints at is I expect that Jonah understands, because of the prophecies in Hosea, that Assyria will be involved in the northern kingdom's fall. And as he's saying, wait a moment, God is giving these people a warning. Now, have you ever seen parents who are going traipsing around after their kids at some public event, and they keep warning and keep warning and keep warning? Well, you know, when they keep doing that and keep doing that, it's basically saying they don't really want to get around to discipline, right? God gives warnings, and it's very interesting. When he gives warnings, it tends to be so that people can get things straightened out. And Jonah said, uh-oh, I've seen this before. God is gracious, and he's giving Nineveh a warning. Uh-oh, looks like Nineveh might be let off the hook. Hey, I've got an idea. What if I go the opposite direction? Then Nineveh won't get its warning, and God will have to destroy it. Maybe that will bode well for Israel. I think he probably got sideways in some direction like that. Now, that's reading a little bit between the lines. But one has to ask, why would a prophet who had a successful career and that God had obviously blessed make such a foolish set of decisions? Now, with Jonah being the writer, he needed some time after he wrote in order to see his foolishness, because as you read the book of Jonah, you say, doesn't the prophet get it? What happens is, we saw last week, there he is on this boat, and what is it that causes Jonah to pray? He wasn't your typical preacher. You know, a preacher has three things they're supposed to be able to do. Pray, preach, or die on a moment's notice. Well, what happens with Jonah? Here we have these Gentile polytheists who are praying to their gods, And the chief rope puller comes in and he sees Jonah just sacked out there on the bottom. Jonah is not the one who is initiating towards worship of God. It's Gentile polytheistic unbelievers that are telling him that he needs to worship God. And look at what happened when the people were afraid, the sailors. I mean, these were veteran sailors that had been out on the Mediterranean seas many times, but this storm was getting worse and worse and worse. So in verse 10, then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "Why have you done this?" For the men knew that he fled from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Now, in addition, let's see what else he told them. He told them in verse 9, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." And they're saying, doesn't look like you really do fear him. There Jonah was trying to run away from God, the creator of the universe, and he figures that if he gets far enough out on the Mediterranean Sea that he might be too far for God to find him. As we read this book, we see the foolishness of Jonah time and time and time again. Yet Jonah is the writer. What happened was Jonah needed some time to figure out what was going on, and he used himself as an object lesson to help another foolish people, the Northern Kingdom. Because the Northern Kingdom was all wrapped up in idolatry and thought that they could protect themselves by their various military alliances rather than recognizing they needed to turn to the Lord. So we have here a summary of Jonah chapter 1. We won't go into more details there, but let's turn the page and go to New Exposition. This is a place in the Bible where we do have a poor chapter break. Verse 16 of chapter 1 really belongs in chapter 2. And so that's why we're starting, 1:17, excuse me. "Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights." So the point that we have here is God appointed a fish to swallow Jonah, where he remained for 3 days and three nights. Now skeptics often ridicule the whole Bible because it includes this one book and this one verse. I've talked to people about the Gospel of John and had them say, "I can't believe a book that has Jonah in the middle of it." Well, you might wonder, what do you say? Well, Matthew chapter 12, verse 40, I think is a good place to start. And so we have that as the second point there on page 2. Jesus affirmed this event in Jonah as historically true. He said, "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Now, the reason that it's important to be able to say this is there are a lot of people who say, the Old Testament has a lot of problems, and I don't believe any of that. But then you ask them, "Well, what do you think about Jesus?" "Oh, he was a good teacher." Well, if you mean by good teacher, was he deluded? Was he delusional? Did he have delusions of grandeur? Did he falsify things about himself? Was he a liar? And, of course, they can't say that he was any of those. But as we look at Matthew chapter 12, verse 40, among other things that he says in verses 38 through 40, he says several things that indicate that he accepted the book of Jonah as historically reliable and as a historical event. And by the way, just to pick up on a point that got mentioned there in your notes on the first page, but I didn't reinforce it. The author of this book, as we said, was Jonah, Amittai's son, a prophet from Gath-Hepher near Nazareth. The fact that he has a historical background, and he is a person that's mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 14 with the same nomenclature that he is the son of Amittai, is pointing to this as being a prophet who really lived. This can't be taken as a parable or just some sort of fictitious illustration. The Bible treats it as this was a historical event involving historical men. Now, the question arises then from that point. Was this a fish or a whale or a shark? Of course, the difference between those, we know that whales have lungs. They have to come up to the surface in order to breathe. A fish is not a whale. A whale is not a fish. Sharks are distinct from both of them because sharks don't have bones in the traditional sense. They have cartilage rather than bones. That's why a shark is not a fish, and a fish is not a shark, nor are any of them whales. And yet, let's go back to Genesis 1:21, and you're going to say, this is an unusual sermon because we're going to be hopping around a fair amount. Not because I think that the book of Jonah depends on various things in order to make its argument fit together, but because we need to relate certain uses of words. Look at Genesis 1:21. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded according to their kind. Now this is the fifth day of creation. You remember how we looked at that we had 3 days that deal with forming and we had 3 days that dealt with filling. And so we have on day four the filling of the earth with greater and lesser amounts of light. The fifth day we have the filling of the firmament with birds and so forth, and the filling of the waters below with sea creatures. And then it's on the sixth day that we have land animals and men. Okay, but notice we have a generic way of saying this in verse 21. Great sea creatures. Now drop down to verse 26 of Genesis 1. Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea. This is just the word dog. Dog is fish. Yeah, Hebrew, you have all these little jokes. Who is me? What ma? Who me? You have all sorts of words. Dog means fish, and who means, or me means who, and he means she, and so on and so forth. So you have all these little tongue twisters in order to memorize vocabulary. But it's just the word dog, which means fish. Doesn't mean dog, means fish. And so it's a term, though, that can be used for sea creatures, just in a general sense. Is it really likely that they knew the difference between a shark and a fish, that one has cartilage and the other has bone? And is it likely that they had spent time noticing that whales came up and breathe? And so on and so forth. So what we have is a term that can be used to identify animals besides fish. So as we look here in Jonah, was it a fish? Was it a whale? Was it a shark? I think so. One of the above. So we don't have a word that would actually identify to which category it belongs. Well, now notice we have this word he prepared or he appointed, depending on the translation. And what does the word appoint or prepare mean? The word is manah, And it doesn't tell us whether it was an already existing species or whether it was a new and unique variety. Therefore, we can forget all of the argument over baleen whales having a large mouth and so on and so forth. But let's look here. On the right side of the picture, we have a drawing of a baleen whale. There are two different kinds of whales. Baleen whales have no teeth. But now if you look on the picture on the left, which is of a skeletal remain, you see all of those things that look sort of like a harp? That's called baleen, and what that is a filtration system. So they have their mouth open, and they're going through the water, and with the baleen, they're able to filter the water, and they get their microscopic food, which consists of krill, and it's caught there in the baleen, and they have a very small throat, and although they have a huge mouth, there's no room for a person to come through. On the other hand, we have other types of sea creatures that are smaller, but they have big mouths. And so the question becomes, people raise all sorts of problems, and they say, well, it couldn't be this kind of a whale for this reason, and it couldn't be a mola mola fish. You know about mola molas, don't you? They live down in the South Pacific, and all they eat are jellyfish. And so they just eat huge quantities of jellyfish because there isn't much nutrition in them, and they just go swimming along with their mouth open, and they don't have any teeth or anything like that, but they're big. Well, we're dealing here with God, the creator of the universe. And he hasn't told us whether this was an already existing species or whether he fixed up something on the spot just to discipline Jonah. So we don't need to get into arguments over the details there because we just don't know. We don't know if it's a fish, we don't know if it's a shark, we don't know if it's a whale, and we don't know if it's something that God created, just one of a kind, just for Jonah. Now, there are accounts of whalers back when whaling was a major business before the petroleum industry kind of took away the need for whale oil for running all of our lamps. And there were occasions where a whale swallowed a person, and lo and behold, when they harpooned the whale and they started cutting it up, there was a person, and the person was still alive. Obviously, you're not expecting a person to live for very long there, but my understanding is that their stomachs are not entirely water-laden. They have a little bit of gas. So I don't imagine it was a very pleasant experience. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week. Jonah would have been forever changed, and we'll have to talk a little bit more about that next week and look at some of the changes that would have happened to him. And actually, it's kind of interesting, but the book of Jonah, some of the things that it says about Jonah in chapter 4 are quite, and 3 as well, are quite consistent with these people seeing a man who had been inside a fish or a whale or a shark for a period of time. He must have been a sight to behold, and he did have physical repercussions that he lived with for the rest of his life. So, now we have an excursus here. Just another way to say commercial break. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, we're going to go visiting something else. I would strongly recommend for anyone who's wanting to do any work with the chronology of Jesus' life to look into purchasing a copy of Honer's Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ. His dating is what I follow. I think he has good arguments for all of the things that he argues here within this book. You might say, why in the world would you ask this question? How long is 3 days and three nights? You might say, you know, that seems a little obvious, and why would we want to belabor a point like that? Well, the reason for needing to wrestle with this question is because we're in the Gospel of John, and we're going to get to Jesus' crucifixion and the time that he was in the grave and so on and so forth. And as one is working with chronology, the question becomes, since Jesus said in Matthew 12:40, "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." So Jesus is saying the length of time that Jonah was in the belly of this creature is the same length of time that he would be buried underground. So that raises issues of how long is 3 days and three nights. Now, we have a question here to ask. There we go. How many years was Reagan president? I've got three hints for you. He was elected first in 1980. He was reelected in 1984. And George Bush was elected in 1988. So 1988 minus 1980 equals 8. But is that right?
Yes.
Well, let's look again. Year one is 1981. Remember, he was elected in 1980, but he took office in January of 81. 12 more months, January 82. 12 more months, January 83, and so on and so forth. And lo and behold, you count down the right-hand side, and he was president in 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, 88, 89. 9 years. Now, if you ask, how many years was he president? It's a four-year period of time. But on how many calendars would you find him being president? 9. Same type of issue happens here when we ask 3 days and three nights. Now, here's why this affects the chronology on all this issue. All four Gospels, Matthew 28:1, Mark 16:1-2, Luke 24:1, and John 20:1, all say that the resurrection happened on a Sunday. It happened on a Sunday morning. So now the question becomes, was he crucified on a Wednesday, a Thursday, or a Friday? Now, I, without apology, argue for a Friday crucifixion, but I know that some of you have been exposed to the Thursday crucifixion view. Now, let's look at this. If we go Wednesday p.m. to Sunday a.m. is about 84 hours. Thursday p.m. to Sunday a.m. is about 60 hours, and Friday p.m. to Sunday a.m. is about 36 hours. Now, the reason that some people argue for a Wednesday or Thursday crucifixion is, well, if you say day 1, 12 hours, night 1, 12 more hours, day 2, 12 more, night 2, 12 more, day 3, 12 more, night 3, 12 more, the math on that adds up to 72 hours. So when people argue for Wednesday crucifixion, they're saying, okay, we've got at least 72 hours here. So they would say, okay, that's a nice, safe answer. Those who go for a Thursday crucifixion will say, okay, it was part of a night, which is going to be counted as a night, and it was part of a day, so yeah, it fits, even if it's a little bit less than the full 72. So now you might wonder, how is it that most people argue for a Friday crucifixion? I mean, do you see the issue and how Jesus has said he's in the tomb the same length of time, and so what day was the crucifixion? Well, I'm glad you asked. That was a very good question. Let's see. We'll move on to the next point. No, actually, we'll deal with that. Look at the bottom of your page. The phrase 3 days and three nights was an idiom. So, in other words, it was a phrase that didn't necessarily lend itself to being taken with absolute literal precision. You know, if I say, I worked night and day on something, does it really mean that I worked in the nighttime, or am I making a statement, I was working continually? You know, we have usages that have a little bit of flexibility because they're idiomatic. And so the question becomes, how did people use this phrase? Well, let's look at Genesis chapter 42. You remember that Joseph became very powerful as prime minister in Egypt. And so his brothers were imprisoned by him for a period of time, actually 3 days. And so in Genesis 42:17, he put them all together in the prison 3 days. Then verse 18 starts with a then. And that's a very specific Hebrew construction. It's called a preterite with a vav consecutive. So it means after the 3 days were done, then Joseph said to them on the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. So verse 18 is not said to them while they were in prison. Joseph would have told a guard, let them out. They're let out after they've served their 3-day sentence, and Joseph now speaks with with brothers on the third day after 3 whole days was completed. Do you see that on the third day equals 3 days of imprisonment there in the usage? On the third day was when they said, you'll be in prison for 3 days, day one, day two, day three, and now you're released on that third day. So in other words, it's not going more, that is to four, but it's going to less, that on the third day is what was meant by the phrase 3 days imprisonment. Okay, let's look at 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 29. In this passage, we have Israel and Syria getting ready for battle. And they are facing each other. And they encamped opposite each other for 7 days. So it was that on the 7th day, the battle was joined. So the 7th day would occur after they've had 7 days of facing each other off. So really they had 6 days of facing each other off. And then 2 Chronicles chapter 10, verse 5 and verse 12. The king said to them, come back to me after 3 days. And the people departed. Verse 12, Jeroboam, who was their leader, and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day as the king had directed. So This is the third day, so really he's saying, after 2 days are complete, well, you come to me on the third day. That's what he meant when he said the statement, come back to me after 3 days. So it's after the third day has started is the idea here. Let's look at Esther. Esther chapter 4, verse 16. And here we have an instruction that's given to Esther with regard to not eating and not drinking. So, we'll start with verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast from me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. So she's saying, we're going to be fasting and praying because my life is in my hands, or it's actually in the king's hands, if I come to him at a time that I am not legally allowed to approach him without all of the proper things having been taken care of. Now in 5:1, now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat, and so on and so forth. Verse 2, he saw her, she talked with him. Now let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 30, verses 12 and 13. Like I said, we'd be turning around a little bit here on this in order to nail this one down. 1 Samuel 30, starting with verse 12. We'll start with verse 11. And they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate, and they let him drink water. And they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. Then David said to him, to whom do you belong, and where are you from? And he said, I am a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick. So what we would have to say is, it's idiomatic usage, and when you look at Jesus' crucifixion, he was resurrected on Sunday. That's the third day. Second day was Saturday. First day was Friday. Notice we have an idiomatic usage that can be established from a number of passages. So Matthew chapter 12, verse 40 is the only reason. It is the only reason. There is no other reason that anyone argues for a Thursday or a Wednesday crucifixion. It's just because they're dealing with the 3 days and three nights phrase. I think the chronology in a lot of other ways works out smoother if it's taken as being a Friday crucifixion. But that's enough of an excursus on this. If you want more details, I recommend Honer's book because he has several pages devoted to the arguments within the Gospels themselves that would demonstrate that it's very hard to fit the chronology with either a Wednesday or a Thursday crucifixion because too many things have to happen in too short a period of time between Jesus showing up in Jerusalem and him being crucified. And so it's very, very difficult to work it out, especially for the Wednesday crucifixion, but the Thursday crucifixion has chronological difficulties as well. Okay, end of commercial break. So when we ask how long is 3 days and three nights, it's on the third day. Now we start with chapter 2 proper, and as we are here, we're moving into Jonah praying. The Lord answered Jonah's prayer from the belly of the fish, It's a prayer for deliverance. I've looked at the word order there, and it might be better. His prayer for deliverance from the belly of the fish. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord, his God, from the fish's belly, and he said, I cried out to the Lord because of my affliction, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. Now, the prayer that is spoken of here is a prayer that Jonah prayed while he was in the fish. Some of the things, though, that he prayed about while he was in the fish, he's remembering things that happened to him before the fish swallowed him. But we're going to, in verse 7, have the earlier prayer of Jonah, because Jonah didn't even have time to gulp help because his mouth was underwater in verse 7. This is his prayer when he's underwater. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer went up to you into your holy temple. So we're looking at two separate prayers. In verses 1 and 2, he's talking about the prayer that he uttered while he was in the belly. Verse 7 mentions an earlier prayer before he was swallowed. Now, the deliverance was by the grace of God, and Jonah knew it. He knew that he was in rebellion. He knew that the Lord was disciplining him. And he made a true prophecy. I mean, after all, he's a true prophet, right? Look at what he prophesied back in verse 16. Then the men feared the Lord, verse 15 of chapter 1. So they picked, okay, let's back up. Jonah told them that, verse 12, when they asked, okay, what do we need to do in order to have the sea be calm? He said to them, pick me up and throw me into the sea, then the sea will become calm for you, for I know that this great tempest is because of me. He knows he's under discipline. But what happened in verse 15, they picked up Jonah, threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. He made a true prophecy. This is a prophet of the Lord. Furthermore, if you look at Jonah 4, 1 and 2, when he saw that God had not destroyed Nineveh, it displeased him exceedingly, and he became angry. So he prayed to the Lord. This is his third prayer in the book, perhaps his fourth, because I would assume he prayed when the Gentile polytheist said, why don't you pray to your gods? So he prayed to the Lord and said, ah, Lord, wasn't this what I said while I was still in my own country? Therefore I fled previously to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. You know, when he's praying from this fish's belly, as well as when he prayed while he was in the water, isn't he a recipient of that grace? But he doesn't want to see the Ninevites come under that grace, does he? And he actually uses God's graciousness as an argument against him. God, you're terrible. You're so gracious. I mean, we don't normally think of that as an indictment, but Jonah is thinking of it as an indictment of him here at this point. Well, as we move, by the way, when it says the belly of Sheol, this here, he's using figurative language, because where was he? He was in the fish. But he's using that as, wow, this is just like being in Sheol. And, you know, that's basically what he's saying. I mean, I was in a desperate strait. Here I was a dead man, and I prayed to you. Now in verse 3, Jonah acknowledges that it is the Lord that cast him into the sea, and we would add, for discipline. Verse 3, for you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me. It's a rather terrifying thing to be out in the sea and to be caught up in all the currents and all the swirl. Here is a set of pictures of a U.S. Coast Guard motorized lifeboat. As soon as it decides to switch. Here's a motor lifeboat and breakers from a rogue wave coming as they were doing training here off the shore of California. And there we go. And then there it is. But motorized lifeboats are designed to be self-righting. They didn't bother to take a picture of it righting itself, but they can go full circle and come back up. You know, they're kind of like the cat that you see, and it always lands on its feet. Well, these always land with the proper side up and the right side down as well. So if they get rolled in a situation like this, they come back up. And better pray that all the hatches are closed, though. Jonah is here, and he's saying, I was really helpless. Notice he's in the belly of the fish, but he's remembering what happened. He's remembering what it was like there to be in the churning sea. And then in verse 4, he says, the point here, though God had cast Jonah out of sight, he knew that he would return to the temple. Notice the affirmation. Then I said, I have been cast out of your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple. Jonah says, I expect to get back to Jerusalem. I expect to see the temple. I expect to worship you. And later on, he's going to talk about a sacrifice that he was going to offer there. Jonah has here received assurance from the Lord that, yes, indeed, his prayer for deliverance is going to be answered. Now, people wonder about Jonah, and as we look here, we see Jonah affirming truth on a number of occasions, but you know, it doesn't mean just because he could recite truth and he could say what was straight up and what was straight down that he was walking with the Lord, because at this period of time in his life, he has not been. And it's not going to be very long, and he's going to be desperately out of his walk with the Lord. He will have broken his fellowship with the Lord very quickly all over again. And you know, that's like us. How often do we find ourselves, and we think, okay, well, you know, I know truth, and that, and we look at our life and we say, hey, but you know, sin seems to be really powerful in my life. And we might get things right. We may confess our sins. We may walk with the Lord for a bit and then get doused once again. We still have a gracious God. We have a God who had every right to have wiped Jonah out and to say, you know, Jonah, I don't have any more purpose for you in this life. But that's not the way God's approaching him. And as we look at Jonah, we say, you know, he is not a sterling specimen at this point in his life, but God is still manifesting his grace towards him. Well, let's now look a little more closely at verses 5 through 7. Jonah rolled in the currents. He was wrapped in seaweed. He saw the bottoms of the mountains. He had no way to escape. But the Lord sent a fish to deliver him when Jonah prayed his first prayer while in the sea. Verses 5 through 7, the water surrounded me, even to my soul, even to my life is the point. Most of the time that you see the word soul, it is standing for the life. I would argue Jonah is describing his death here. The deep closed around me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I went down to the moorings of the mountains. The earth with its bars closed behind me forever. You know, that's kind of like when you watch Get Smart, and he goes walking through and everything closes down right there, right behind him. That's what's happening to Jonah, and he's saying, I'm stuck. I'm a dead man. And he really was. You have brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer went up to you into your holy temple. He prayed right at the point that he was dying. All wrapped around him, and he's saying, I couldn't get out. I was all tangled up. It was like being in a fisherman's net. He had nowhere to go. Now, he makes a statement in verse 6 that I went down to the foundations of the mountains. You know, we think here of the mountains as we look out here along our California coastline, but anytime you have a steep mountain, you go underwater and it goes pretty steep as well for a way until it starts to level off. And Jonah's saying, you know, I started out with all the seaweed and then I got dragged down further and further, and you know what? I saw the very bottom of all these mountains. I mean, I got all the way down there. I was way down in the depths. When he talks about the bars here, he says, the earth with its bars closed behind me forever. It's like being in a kelp bed, and he's looking at it, and he's saying, you know, there just was no way to escape. I'm held in. It's just there, and it's as if I'm behind jail bars. I can't get out. And in verse 7, when he said, when my soul fainted within me, he is on his dying moments. I remembered the Lord, and my prayer went up to you into your holy temple. He knew even with that first prayer that God heard him. He knew that despite the discipline that he knows that he's under. You know, when people start questioning eternal security and they start questioning Jesus' promise, his guarantee of everlasting life, I look at passages like this and I don't see someone, even someone as messed up as Jonah, doubting that the Lord heard him. He did not doubt his relationship with the Lord. That's quite different than the picture we get when we talk to people. People have no comprehension of God's guarantee. I'm going to say and save it for later, but I believe that Jesus confirms that Jonah died while he was in the sea. But we'll talk about that a little later. Let's look now at verse 8. Jonah realized that idolatrous Israelites were guilty of forsaking the God who is loyal to his covenant. And you might think, how did that get dropped here in the middle of this? He says, those who regard worthless idols, so those that regard them as gods and worship them, they forsake their own mercy, their own chesed. They forsake the loyal covenantal guarantees that God has given to them. And he's one of those people that's under that guarantee. He knows that God has a plan for Israel. And he knows that there are promises of resurrection. He knows about everlasting life that has been spoken of through the Old Testament. But he's speaking about the people that he's been ministering to there in the northern kingdom of Israel. He's not looking at Gentiles. He's talking about Jewish idolaters. He's thinking about his own home country. And he says, how foolish it is for people to worship idols because they forget God's covenantal loyalty to his people, Israel. And then he puts himself in contrast to that. Rather than regarding a worthless idol, he is going to sacrifice to the Lord. So he muses about the people that he's been ministering to, and then he sees himself in a different light. He sees himself as a worshiper. And indeed he is. You know, he's spoken of himself before as the one who is a Hebrew who worships God, the creator of the dry land and of the sea. And there seems to be something really strange in Jonah because he can affirm great truth, and yet you look at his own life and he couldn't see. Well, he recognizes God's grace at this point towards his country, including himself. And he's able to affirm this because look at how God delivered him. If he had prayed to an idol, what good would it have done him? It's only because he prayed to the Lord, the God who created the earth and the dry sea, the one who's in charge of it all, that it was worth the prayer that he made. But it won't be long. Chapter 3, chapter 4, he will have lost sight completely of these truths. And unfortunately, so did the people of northern Israel, which is the reason the book is being written. We'll get more into that as we look at chapters 3 and 4. But in verse 9, he vowed to make a thanksgiving sacrifice to the Lord because the Lord delivered him. He says, but I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay what I have vowed. Salvation or deliverance is of the Lord. Now, Leviticus chapter 7, verses 11 through 18 describes this sacrifice. And it's a sacrifice that is made when someone said, God, I know you have delivered me. And what they are saying is, I will make praise of you. I will go to the temple or I will go to the tabernacle and will carry out the prescribed feast sacrifice, and there will be people that will be fed, and in the process, I will tell them of your deliverance. We've seen this as we've looked at Psalm 22, verses 22 and following, especially verse 25. Whenever we run into this, it mentions a sacrifice, it mentions thanksgiving or praise, and it mentions paying what has been vowed. The person is saying, I will make this sacrifice at my own expense. I will sacrifice appropriately, it will cost me, and when I do it, I will make a proclamation of the deliverance that you have given to me, Lord. Now, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15 says that the sacrifice of thanksgiving is still acceptable, even in New Testament times. It was not ended because it was not an expiatory sacrifice. It was not one that dealt with sin. All the sin sacrifices have been replaced by what Jesus did, but this was still appropriate, even in New Testament times. Now in verse 10, the Lord caused the fish to spit Jonah out onto the dry land. Verse 10, so the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Jonah didn't deserve to live after his rebellion, but God was gracious. God allowed Jonah to live, despite knowing how Jonah would conduct himself in chapters 3 and 4, that he would still go back to rebellion. And God allowed the northern kingdom to continue for another 37 years, despite knowing that its many idolaters had forsaken their God, who was in covenantal loyalty to them. Yes, God is a gracious God, and remember how Jonah used that as an indictment. God, you're too gracious. Now, I'll touch very briefly, this is a sidelight, on a passage that Ricardo did touch on out of John chapter 1, and he handled it very nicely. I would like to point out that the New King James has an error in the way that they handle the quotation marks. So if you have your New King James, I would recommend in John 1, 15 through 18, changing the quotation marks to what it is in the Living Water. Notice in verse 15, John testified concerning him, that is Christ, and exclaimed, "This was the one of whom I said." That's where the quotation starts. And it ends with the end of verse 18. John said all of what is in verses 15 through 18. As Ricardo pointed out when he looked at this passage on Sunday, when it says in verse 17, "For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ," we tend to put a "but" there. And we tend to understand it as, oh, there was law, and then there was grace, and the two are at odds with each other. But when you ask, how did Moses write? How did Moses give people the law? Wasn't it by the authority of Jesus Christ? Jesus Christ, okay, Moses gave the law. But a truth, grace and truth, which have come from Jesus Christ, have always undergirded the law. It's not saying that the law is opposed to grace. Grace and truth is manifested especially strongly now, but it was present in all of what Moses wrote as well. One final thing, notice how what we're looking at here with that. God was gracious towards Jonah, and God was gracious towards the nation Israel, the northern kingdom. As Ricardo was pointing out, God has the right to put people to death when they sin, does he not? And God has been in the business of grace ever since the beginning. You look at the man and the woman in the garden. Did he say to them, okay, you've blown your one chance, and I am going to write you off and have nothing to do with you? He didn't do that. God is in the business of grace. Yes, God is a just God, but God is in the business of grace. So that's just underscoring that point and providing a link into what Ricardo was saying on Sunday. Now let's look at Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 through 40. And we will touch on this fairly briefly. Just before this, Jesus has spoken about the unpardonable sin. We have a tendency to think of that as a personal sin. It was not. It was a national sin. And what he was saying in that passage is, God will not relent. He's not going to do what he did in the days of Jonah speaking to Nineveh, where God gave a warning and he said, remember how Jonah said, oh, you're giving a warning. That means you're going to relent. But Jesus says, Israel has committed a sin for which God will not relent. And in the year 70, Israel suffered the consequences of the national rejection of Christ. That happened in Matthew chapter 12. And so he said, there won't be any backing away from this judgment. It will happen. And that's what Jesus meant when he talked about the unpardonable sin. Well, in the process of making Jesus' argument, then he did mention about Jonah. And so let's look at verse 38. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." And you know, the oddest thing, they had just said any sign that he does is a counterfeit. It's done by Beelzebul. And so then they're saying, we just told you that any sign that we see from you, it's a false sign. So do a sign for us. And he says, nothing doing. He answered and said to them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. A lot of people look at that as though he's saying, oh, the fact that you would ever want a sign proves that you're evil. No, he's not doing that. What he's saying is, it's like if you have a little child that's really naughty, just really throws a tantrum, you know, just all kinds of, you know, just a really terrible scene, and then says, Mommy, can I have a piece of candy? And you say, a naughty girl wants a piece of candy. No way. Now, under other circumstances, you would be happy to honor the request, wouldn't you? But on this particular occasion, you say, no. Jesus said, no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. Now, a lot of preachers have wanted to say, oh, well, you know, signs aren't very important. They haven't really read the Gospel of John, have they? And so when they say that, what they want to say is, oh, well, since Jesus really was de-emphasizing signs and he realized that people were attaching too much importance to them, that he said, I'm not going to give you any sign except Jonah's sign. And what was Jonah's sign? He walked into Nineveh and he preached. Now I guarantee you, preaching is not a sign. There's nothing miraculous about preaching. Instead, what Jesus is saying is, the only sign that's going to be shown to this generation is the resurrection from the dead, which was the sign of Jonah. Because God raised him from the dead when he was drowning with all the seaweed wrapped around his neck as he's there looking at the bottoms of the mountains and all the bars are in front of him and he says, I'm a dead man, and he fainted, and as he did so, he prayed and he knew that he was hurt. All the signs that Jesus did after this were pointing towards his resurrection from the dead. Notice the raising of Lazarus. And even when you look at Jesus' explanation of his healing the blind man and his healing of the man that was lame and the feeding of the 5,000, those miracles, each one of them, he related to the, as foreshadowing, his resurrection from the dead. So he said, that's the one sign that you can count on. Well, what is the conclusion here to this whole passage? God graciously rescued a rebellious prophet, as well as rescuing a rebellious and idolatrous northern kingdom. Now, God did so, even though Jonah's sacrifice of thanksgiving did not prevent further rebellion on his part. And even though the northern kingdom would not respond to Jonah's book. God is gracious despite the failure of the prophet and despite the failure of the people. Now, I think that this last slide kind of captures it when it gets there. Grace for both crossroads. Faith and failure. Notice how they start out the same way. You start out on the fork of the road. Obviously, this picture here was picking up on the narrow way and the broad way. I would say some of the imagery that they're wanting to make there, they've kind of missed the point because they thought that that was a passage for the unbeliever. Whereas I would not say that the way issue is meant in that way, but I think it is a particularly appropriate thing to notice. God was gracious to Jonah when he was doing well. God was gracious to Jonah when he was failing. God was gracious to his people, his nation, when they were doing well. And God was gracious to them when they were failing. Isn't that the same way that God is with us? Yes, there's discipline, but God is still a God of grace. And this book is one where that is magnified, and we can see it very clearly. God's grace, despite our failure or our faith.